The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney. Welcome to the second episode of the New Quantum Era. Hey, my name is Kevin Roney. I'm here with...
I'm Sebastian Hassinger.
And so, yeah, we're the co-hosts of the podcast. We, for some time now, have been watching this fascinating area of quantum computing. We think it's an arena that's got, you know, many fascinating aspects about it in terms of its enormous potential economically, in terms of the possible impact on future computing architectures, but also... we see there's numerous significant risks in terms of unsolved, massive unsolved engineering challenges left to be done before it can actually be a practical thing. So it feels a high potential and high risk endeavor with much potential and many ways a very compelling topic.
That's right. Yeah, Kevin, it's I find it fascinating for the reasons you said, and it's really it's difficult to navigate compared to prior sort of emerging technology areas like mobile or the internet or the web or even AI and ML, because it's not an incremental advancement on the current paradigm of computing. It represents in quantum computing an entirely novel way to compute, and so there's a significant learning curve, as you said, that involves understanding more about quantum physics than I ever thought I would. and then mapping that to a slightly more familiar terrain of technology development and technology market development, which you and I are much more familiar with, but at a very, very much earlier stage. And in fact, our interview today with Cesar Rodriguez from StrangeWorks, he'll touch on sort of the analogy to the development of the classical computing world at the stage of vacuum tubes and the invention of the transistor. So I think that's really good calibration for people who are trying to make sense of the topic to realize that we're not at even the PC era in quantum. We're still looking for the transistor.
And I think maybe many people even forget what it must have been like to be alive right during the onset, the dawn, right, of the IT era before it became standardized and rising fast through Moore's law. And so back then, I bet you had to have that same mix of both optimism and reasoned skepticism.
That's
really the reason we really enjoyed this interview with Cesar Rodriguez. He's a great example of somebody who is knowledgeable about the space and sees its possibility, but also he's got a decent level of guarded optimism and even skepticism on some of these results, which in many ways they run in fits and starts and sometimes even go backwards. There's a lot of chaos in the messaging and the progress.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, let's get to the interview.
Let's dive in.
Cool. So today we're going to talk to Cesar, who we've known for a little while. Cesar, do you want to start off by introducing yourself?
Yes. Hi, I'm Cesar Rodriguez Rosario. I'm a quantum physicist and I'm the chief science officer at StrangeWorks.
Excellent. And Cesar, I thought maybe to start off, you had a really interesting path to get to quantum computing. So can you fill us in on how what was the circuitous route that you took to get here?
I'm originally from Puerto Rico. I always liked computing in general. The history of computing, I was very passionate about it and so on. And I ended up studying computer engineering then. And while I was doing that, I got very interested in quantum computing. This was very, very early. It was 20 years ago. And because I was interested in the history of computing and I loved the early days, I was like, oh, that's another early days that's going to happen. I want to do that. So I had the choice of staying in Puerto Rico, programming human resources software and surfing, or going to learn how to program a quantum computer. So that's what I did.
Do you ever miss surfing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I haven't done surfing in like many years, but I liked it. I liked it, yeah. Right now I'm in Germany, so I cannot surf here. There's nothing.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's very little German surf. You got your PhD in quantum physics specifically, or quantum information?
Yeah, so I went to the University of Texas in Austin. And when I went there, because I was not a physicist, I did not have the background, and it was actually very difficult with the GREs and all that. But while I was an undergraduate student, because I was so interested already in physics in general, I did a lot of research jobs in the summers and such. So I think that really helped me with to get into good school. And University of Texas is a huge department. It's brutally huge. And so often students feel very disoriented in grad school because you don't know who you're going to work with and so on. And so I had to do the thing of knocking on doors, talking to professors. I was very open-minded about what I was going to do. I thought I was probably going to be an experimentalist because my background as an undergrad was experimental physics, mostly because my engineering skills, I could fix stuff, basically. That was really it. Like, you know, as an undergrad, the main thing you do is like, you clean stuff and like put it back together. Yeah, so I was doing a lot of that. But while I was talking to professors, I ended up talking to George Sudarshan, who ended up being my PhD advisor. George passed three years ago. He was a very senior scientist. I think he was nominated for the Nobel Prize 8 times. He knew Feynman, he knew Gell-Mann, he knew like all these giants of physics. He was one of the giants too. And he did really important work in quantum optics, in quantum information, and quantum decoherence, and a lot of quantum stuff. So at this time, he was getting interested in quantum computing, more focused at this stage. So I talked to him. I really didn't think myself a theorist, but he was very funny. And we bonded talking about plantains and bananas because he's from India and I'm from Puerto Rico, so we like those things. So I kept going to the group meetings, and finally I got a PhD.
Just by showing up for the meetings?
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. That is the biggest mistake that students do, they don't show up to the meetings. I was just like, if you want to come again next week, and I just kept going. Like, I was never like officially admitted, I just kept going.
Really?
Yeah, well, there was no official procedure. He was just like, yeah, sure, let's do it.
Yeah, you just keep showing up, man. Yeah, that's cool.
That's amazing.
90% of life right there, huh? Yeah.
So that's sort of how you found yourself more on the theory side than the experimentalist side?
Yeah, but it was very hard for me because in my engineering school, the math was very limited. And so I had to learn a lot of stuff. In fact, I think I learned quantum like completely backwards, like from everybody else. Because I usually at University of Texas, people have about 2 years of quantum before they go to the graduate level quantum. And they have about a year of classical mechanics, which is usually a prerequisite. But I went to University of Texas and I had none. And then I didn't even take classical mechanics before I took quantum because of the way they were offered. I ended up taking quantum first. So I am quantum native in the sense that I see the world as quantum, like really. Then when I learned classical, I'm like, it's like that, but then you change the bracket the other way.
Rather impressive you climb that steep hill without, you know, any of that help. Yeah, my God. Yeah.
It was really brutal. I really struggled. I didn't do very well at first. Mostly the books, they made no sense to me. And then I discovered John Boyd Norman's Quantum Mechanics. Like, this is a book, this is a really old book, I think from the 50s.
Oh, yeah, it's open source. It's out there above the Caltech website. Great, great resource. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I read that, and it's actually focused a lot on the density matrix and not that instead of wave function and such. And then it made sense to me. I'm like, it's just probabilities and all things. So I have learned quantum the wrong way, and I think everybody should learn the wrong way. It makes more sense.
It is funny how you know, there is kind of this on ramp that's kind of been defined over the years, but it also. I think in many ways generates those multiple stages of going like, well, this is totally non-intuitive. This doesn't make any sense. Cause it's like challenging what you learned in the previous stage at each stage. Yeah. It's funny.
And this is because a lot of books, they're very historical driven. Like they show it the historical way. But at some point, somebody has to be brave enough to say, okay, we've had 100 years of quantum mechanics. It's okay if we learn it the way we like it now.
Yeah, just assume it.
And then you scratch everything and start from information theory, which is the way I think it should be done.
I agree. I mean, there's such chaos and uncertainty in the minds of the early scholars that they struggle with it mightily. So trying to recapitulate that, it feels like it would definitely induce like tough pedagogical outcomes, right? I mean,
like for me, like very simple things. Like usually, like in quantum, you first learn the wave function. And you do everything with the wave function and so on. And then, some people don't even learn the density matrix. And there's a big mystery of how do you get probabilities out of wave functions? It's such a weird thing. It's the only thing that kind of ruins the theory. But if you start with the density matrix, it's all like, it's the same as classical probability theory. It's really beautiful. So that's what I think it should be done. Like, it just makes more sense than my information theory. Yeah.
And I recall vividly you on the Slack channel for our reading group urging all of our the students to focus on that density matrix. That's fundamental. So I appreciate the coaching, the help.
Yeah, yes. It's if you get used to doing things that way,
everything goes easier, right?
Everything's very uniform, so everyone should do it, yeah. And also you're like, oh, it's probability. It's just probability. It's other probabilities.
Yeah. So do you think coming from a computer engineering, software engineering perspective, do you think that, and also having this sort of unconventional journey through quantum physics, do you think that sort of gives you a different perspective on the field today and like what might be interesting or productive, sort of, research paths to go down?
Yeah. So I can say that in like it gives me like there's two angles where I think a little bit differently. One is this historical perspective on the development of classical computing, of classical computing. Like for me, it's often the question everybody asks is can I get some bitcoins tomorrow using a quantum computer? This is like everybody asks me. And of course, this is very disconnected from where we are historically, which is a very, very early stages of quantum computing. And so, and there's nothing wrong with that. And so I always throw the parallels like this is we're in the vacuum tube era. Like that's what we are. We're in the vacuum. It's like quantum computing, it's vacuum tubes. Why is it that? So when people were building the first vacuum tubes computers, the main issues that they had were that the vacuum tubes just blew out, and you have to learn which ones blew out more than the others and try to work around them.
Error correction and error mitigation.
Another issue they had was rats eating the cables. Yeah, rats eating cables. And like when you read all these things, like you realize like, oh, this is like really down to earth, like real engineering problems that they're really struggling. And that's kind of where we are now. And so for me, people ask, which one is the best quantum computer right now? And it makes no sense because if you were in the back into era, they all kind of sucked in different ways. So, and it's nothing bad. It's just, it's just...
Yeah, you're not being mean. It's just right. You're trying to be fair.
Right. We haven't had the Bell Labs transistor moment yet, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so of course, like, that's what we're all waiting. It's like, when do we get a transistor? And the way to think about the quantum transistor would be, of course, the transistor is already quantum, but in quantum computer, what would be? Is that you have a... You can use some qubits that... they are very that the quality is really, really good. You can connect them very, very efficiently, and you can connect them as many as you want in a way that this scales. Like you have to do all those things, and nobody has cracked the code for all those bullet points.
No, and in fact, in classical terms, what you're describing is both the transistor from Bell Labs, but also the monolithic solution from TI and Fairchild, right? Because until we figured out how to print circuits like with transistors on boards, we were trying to hand solder components together, and you could only get to a couple thousand components before there was definitely going to be a cracked solder joint somewhere.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So that's really once you reach that stage, then is when you can start making real predictions of this is the rate of growth of the computers are going to have. But until you reach that, everybody tries to guess. They're just making up stuff.
Right. Yeah. Moore's law did not kick in until the monolithic solution was really sorted and we had microprocessors. So, yeah.
But it's so refreshing to hear a voice that is able to sort of both see the possibility, but also is turning, a skeptical eye, right, on some of the vendor claims, because it does feel like there's just a lot of spin in this space and that the press releases are so shallow compared to the complexity and depth of the real story. it's a very difficult space in which to like discern where is the real progress. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say I don't read press releases, and I don't because I get nothing from them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's written by somebody who doesn't even understand.
And I'm always so poor. Like people ask me, I'm like, what did you say? What? It's always
like, so given that sort of stage of the technology, what do you think the role is for a theorist, right? Because in some ways, quantum information science is sort of, in some ways, it won't fully be realized until we have that world where you can connect as many qubits as you want in a scalable sort of, error-resistant way. The role of theory now, do you think that there's sort of almost like a co-design between experiment and theory to try to figure out how to get there?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I would say like right now, if you want to program quantum computers, which are, very noisy, the connectivity is really bad, the gates are not great, you do have to know the physics very, very well of what's going in the computer. So for that, you have to be a theoretical physicist. Like you have to really, really get it, and you have to be not afraid. And this is similar at the beginning when you were programming classical computers. You have to go with oscilloscopes and stuff. You really have to understand details. So that's kind of where we are. Ideally, what's going to happen is that once we have the scalable error-corrected qubits and all that, then you don't have to be a theorist anymore. And so my theorist hat is, I'm not going to put it again, I'm going to be a full-time quantum engineer. And that will be healthy. Like, I want that to happen. That means that the industry succeeded when that happens.
Then there could be quantum script kiddies.
When I'm writing my equations, we have not succeeded, although I like them very much.
And so how do you view then the short to medium term kind of like NISQ era landscape? Because there's a lot of people pointing at new algorithms that might perhaps be enough of a level of resilience with respect to the current limits on these machines to still do something useful. But it still feels like there's a lot of even NISQ era algorithms which were published up on archive and have been dequantized. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, how do you view the reliability and the breakthrough potential of the current crop of algorithms, given current limits?
The analogy I would make is with the early days of aviation, like Brothers Wright. So if you ask people, if you ask Americans, who made the first airplane ever? Is the Brothers Wright. If you ask Brazilians, by the way, they have another guy.
Yeah, of course.
And the reason is that it depends how you define the thing. Like Brothers Wright kind of used a catapult to launch the plane, and you can think that's cheating. So if you think that's cheating, they were not the first. Like it really depends. Like when do you make it? Oh, this is like legitimately like on its own standing, and it was like I think it took like more than 30 years before you had the first flight with passengers and luggage,
and then another 40 years we were on the moon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. So we are right now the NISQ era, which is the noisy intermediate scale quantum computers. So this one is it's really we're at the early stages. We are Brothers Wright, and what we're trying to do is everybody wants to claim we were the first ones to do something that has never done before, and this is known as quantum advantage. And to be more to define it like concretely, quantum advantage means that you have a quantum computer that can solve a problem that no classical computer right now could solve. That's really it. And so that sounds kind of huge, right? Like suddenly this is like a real superpower, right? However, so there's many ways to go about it, and there's been some claims. Like Google had a big announcement a couple of years ago that they achieved this quantum supremacy.
A rather controversial announcement, it feels.
Yeah. No. Well, I don't think it was not controversial, but it shows how ill-defined this question is what I would say. So what they did was they did show an algorithm that could outperform any high-performance computer we have in the planet to do a task that nobody could do before. Like I think it took them like a few minutes, and it would take a computer they estimated like 10,000 years. So that sounds very convincing. However, the task was completely toy task. That was really like you define the task for the computer that you have, and it's not the other way around. Like you don't make a computer to solve the problem; you make up a problem that fits the computer. But that's how you start. Like, this is not like, take it down. This is fair. Absolutely. That's how, you have to start there. And of course, what happened after was that a lot of researchers found out ways to improve classical algorithms. And for me, like, that's legit. That's good. It benefits everybody, right?
Yeah, in many ways, I think the distinction between, you know, classical information science and quantum information science is an arbitrary one, right? It's like, there's just information science. You just have different tools.
That's all it is. That is all it is, yeah. The world is made of information. So.
That's right.
The distinction I make is that quantum computing uses all the information in the world, and classical uses like just a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a great way to sort of see with more clarity the current landscape as you're comparing it to the early experiments in flight. I love that analogy. But I mean, if you were trying to sort of see from the landscape of the current algorithms out there, I mean, do you feel like there's an imminent breakthrough in Niskera algorithms that shows that supremacy, that has your commercial relevance? I mean, I guess that's a lot of our audience, they wonder about this all the time. There's so much like emphasis on heavy theory. It, for a lot of people who are more practical, or you know, maybe want to make a bet VC wise on one of these plays, it's hard to really feel like it's not just a big science experiment.
So far it is a big science experiment,
right?
And
right.
That's legit. That's okay. Like Brothers Wright, they had no space for luggage, right?
Right.
So that's perfect. It was just like, we do it because we can. That was the point, and I think that's fine. I think it just shows like where we are in history. And for me, that's why it's exciting. Like, I don't see this as a bad thing.
No, it's amazing stuff, really beautiful. It's just, yeah, it's also, there's the practicality of like, where is the outcome that would really make a difference in the world?
So one way to think about it is that if you want to get into quantum computing right now, you don't do it because you want to get the you don't want to extract the value from it. You do it because you want to do.
Right,
because
you're passionate about the subject. Absolutely.
And for me, that's very exciting. Of course, other people wish, why don't you like hurry up? I'm like, hey, like, I'm been hurrying up my whole career. Like, another thing to take in consideration is that, for example, that Google Anonymous that was one, but there have been others after that by some Chinese groups and other research groups, and the same thing happens. Like, they make a breakthrough. It seems they achieve supremacy. Then somebody catches up in some other way. And I think that's extremely exciting.
It's the engine of progress.
It's going to keep happening. And it's going to be a lighter back and forth and so on. And this is because supremacy, like we like to think like, oh, you reach it, then you're done. Like, no. This is like a very loose definition. And everybody's playing games to like barely make it. And of course, you realize they didn't make it, or sometimes they made it, but it's not so exciting.
So you're pretty confident at this point there's going to be more dequantized algorithms, sounds like.
No, I'm sure, but like this idea of the quantized algorithm, it's like sometimes it's very hard to know what makes the quantum algorithm tick.
Oh, even classical algorithms, right? I mean,
classical algorithms, like, right? Yeah. And also sometimes people are like, oh, why don't you just make up a new quantum algorithm? My response is always like, why don't you make up a classical algorithm?
See how easy it is.
Because you don't make it, you just look them up, right? Quicksort, come on. Nobody invents Quicksort. You just look it up. And there's a reason for that. And it's because it's very, very difficult to innovate. And quantum, of course, it's very counterintuitive. A lot of the classical algorithms, you already have really good computers, so you did them by trial and error. With quantum, it's a little harder. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just shows where we are in the industry and where things are headed. And I would say, like, it's okay that things are not useful yet. There's nothing wrong with that because we're still working towards that. And the way I see this progressing is that this supremacy claims are going to keep happening, that you guys are going to get bored from the press releases. You're like, oh, but I heard that. I thought that already happened.
A level of fatigue and cynicism might set in some minds, yes.
Yeah, but it's going to be very nuanced. And what's going to happen is that they're going to keep having more kinds of supremacies, until maybe at some point one barely scratches the surface of it being useful for somebody, because they're not useful. Yeah. And that's going to be a big deal. And so I that time where a quantum algorithm becomes useful, like, I don't, because this advantage, supremacy, these words are really overloaded. I like to call it quantum value. And for me, what quantum value means is like when you can convince someone to use a quantum computer because it serves them time, saves them time or money. Like, that's it. That means Cesar doesn't have to be in the call to explain to people the technology. He's like, look, it's going to save you this much money. Like, this is very, very concrete, right? But we're not there yet. And it's going to be a while, but that's fine. And hopefully in the next era, we find something that is it's close enough that it's valuable, even if it's for a tiny problem that's of application for very few people, that will be a success.
If you look at the theory landscape right now, what are the things that are the most exciting to you?
Yeah, we'd love to hear your if you're a betting man, I mean, which of the different categories of current NISQ era algorithms are likely to sort of show that kind of breakthrough?
And so of course, like the whole world of variational quantum algorithms. This was started by the group of Alan Gasparogosyev. I used to be a postdoc in his group when I was at Harvard. And in the same week this paper came out, Eddie Farhi also came up, and Jeffrey Goldstein came up with another one. The same week, like those groups, I know for a fact they talk regularly because we used to take the team Boston and go to meet them, and they would come have beers with us and so on. So I'm sure this was like, it was something like, you know, let's put them out at the same time. They're different. But the idea of variational quantum algorithms is the idea that quantum computers are very good, of course, at solving quantum problems, right? So if you give it a quantum problem, can you like have it come out with one answer? That maybe it's just like you give it a quantum guess, let's say, and it tries to tell you, well, this guess gives you this answer. Then you take this input, this output, and then you say, can I update my guess using classical computing? So I'm like, oh, let me change the parameters a bit to jiggle things. Maybe I give a guess, and you keep iterating this way. And all these variational quantum algorithms, this is sort of the spirit behind them. They're very intertwined, the classical and the quantum part. And it's just really exploiting the fact that quantum computers are very good at quantum simulation and linear algebra. It's just doing that, and then uses the classical computer, of course, to steer it the right way to make it faster. The benefits of this algorithm is that because you're iterating a lot, you don't have to have a very long circuit, like long, I mean, in terms of depth, which you have a lot of gates one after the other. These tend to fail more often because the noises add up. So this one, like the clever thing is you break it up into small chunks and you get an output before everything falls apart. And then, okay, then let me update my guess. And you keep extracting amounts of little information so you steer what is a likely answer toward. And this is a huge world right now. Like this is basically what everybody's doing. It's impossible to keep up with that. There's experts at how to do these guesses, is that the answer, like how to do the updating, what are different techniques.
And also the architecture of the quantum hybrid kind of setup and you know what kind of algorithms might exist on the classical side to help evolve the guess. There's a ton of research there, my God.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's impossible to keep up with all of them. But a lot of this, like take the data, what is a clever way to update your guess? These are classical algorithms that are doing the guessing, right? And this is a gigantic world. It's probably already existing classical compute. So the intertwine between the assumptions you have to make, you know, how to cook the recipe just right so you get like barely make it work. I think there's a lot of nuance, a lot of like details that matter for that. But it seems to be very fruitful so far. And of course, this was designed for this kind of computers that don't scale so well. It was designed for this. So I will say that's the most thriving area, and it's very exciting. And I don't think we're gonna get rid of them, to be honest. Like the variational quantum algorithm, they're here to stay.
I mean, it looks like a coprocessor, right? Which makes a lot of sense until you get to that really scalable architecture where you can get, you know, to the point where you've got something you can be a general purpose computer. In the variational stuff, it does everything still fit into the sort of general buckets of VQE and QAOA, or are there other categories that are emerging that are distinct enough from those two approaches that they have their own acronym yet?
And so QAOA, for example, is a kind of VQE.
Yeah. Okay.
It was shown that at first it was unclear. It seemed more limited. It is a kind. It's basically you take variational quantum eigensolver. That's what VQE stands for. And all of them kind of look some one way or another like a variational quantum eigensolver. And the reason is because the words say so. Like, so it's variational. Variational means you jiggle the guess until you get better, right? And then the quantum is like you use a quantum computer, and the eigensolver is to find an eigenvalue.
That is kind of the most generic description, isn't it?
So you come up with some guess or something, and you find an eigenvalue. Then you check, is this eigenvalue as low as I wanted? No? Okay, let me jiggle the input a little bit more in a smart way.
20 questions on quantum state.
Yeah, I've seen sort of the claim that actually things that are being called quantum machine learning are actually also under the category of VQE as well, right? I mean, those are also variational approaches. Yeah.
So some are. And a lot of the machine learning things depend on algorithms that are just really good at linear algebra. Some have been dequantized, which is something that we mentioned before. So by dequantizing, what does it mean? It means that the algorithm was invented, it's in quantum and so on, and then somebody realized, you don't need entanglement.
Right.
That's what it means.
Yeah.
So going back to what we said before, is that if quantum information is using all the information of the world, then somebody came up with an algorithm, uses all, and then somebody figures out, well, actually, you didn't need it all. You just need the old stuff. But this is very nuanced, because it's only been shown for some classes of problems only. So it could be you still need the other one for the bigger ones and so on. And I think this is gonna be we're gonna keep exploring what these are, and this is gonna have an impact on quantum machine learning. Like it could be that we don't know if quantum machine learning is better than classical, and this is because the way we usually think about algorithms is using complexity theory. And complexity theorists, if you have ever met one, they're the most unreasonable people on the planet. Because that's their job, is to be extremely unreasonable. Like, so they come up with the problem. You come up with the problem, and they're going to come up with the most unreasonable expectations of, like, what about this really case? How fast can you do it? And that's their job. They have to come up with these insane scenarios, and you have to show that this works for this insane scenario nobody in the right mind will ever try. But that's how you can be really darn sure that this algorithm is better always, right? But machine learning doesn't work that way, because machine learning is heuristic. That means like you kind of like try it, and if it works, like that's it. We're good to go.
Right? Good enough.
And so comparing classical algorithms to quantum machine learning algorithms, you already don't have the tools of complexity. You cannot do that. And so it's all heuristics. And so the question is, will always be there. I would say if I was a betting person, I would assume that if you were doing machine learning for quantum problems, you can guess that the quantum computer is going to do better, right? That's a really safe bet. What is the area in between? No, I'm not placing a bet.
It's interesting because I like that framing, you know, that you use of quantum information science uses all the information, because it really does underline the fact that, you know, in a classical simulation, an HPC simulation, let's say, of, you know, a chemical reaction or a seismic, you know, simulation, those or material simulation, there are a number of choices that the researchers or the experimentalists are making to downsample, essentially, to throw out a bunch of information, because they can't use all of the, they can't actually, they don't have the capacity to use all the information in their calculation. And I guess what's interesting is that implies that quantum computers will allow us to test those assumptions about what information is actually, you know, okay to throw out and what's not okay to throw out, right? Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah, in fact, like one way to see why quantum computers are fundamentally better at some problems than classical is exactly what you just said, which is, how do we solve a quantum mechanical problem right now? Most of the scientific compute time is used for doing calculations of this kind, because they're essential for material science, for medicines, for all those. You have to find out the energies of molecules. This is a quantum problem. And it's really, really hard to do. Like even tiny, tiny molecules, we cannot have, the biggest supercomputers cannot solve them. So this is why when you're coming up with new materials, as I said, for solar panels or new medicines or something, you end up with a lot of people with lab coats mixing liquids in a lab. And this is very smart trial and error. But it's, of course, it's super expensive, because you need a lot of people with PhDs, with a lot of like pipettes and all this stuff, mixing it all up. So, and this is because we don't know, if we could a priori know these are like good candidate molecules, then they can just aim for those and it would save a lot of time. But we cannot do that. And it's because you start with a fundamental quantum mechanical problem that is too hard to solve. So you do approximations, just like you said, And then you take this really approximated thing, which already, like, you know, you threw out a lot of good stuff. Then you put in a classical computer, which is not suited for it. And then you run it, but you have to stop the computation time at some time. Like, you don't can run it until the end of the universe. Like, you have to stop. So you already have more errors because you stop at some point. And then you take all these errors and then you have to put it back into the quantum problem. And so you already lost so much in this process. And this really shows, like, what are the limitations of computing as we know it now for this kind of problem. And this was the original motivation for quantum computers, was like, instead of doing all this, can we do better? However, like, of course, there are some problems, like, quantum computers are not magical. They're not good at everything. So there will still be problems that they cannot solve. And we still approximate them. Of course, maybe they're better at the approximations, but we'll figure it out. But there are some, they can handle bigger data sets. Not right now, but in the future. Right now, their data sets are tiny, but they will be able to handle better because the quantum information is exponentially larger than classical information. So you can fit more in them, a lot more. But it's gonna be a while, I think, before we can exploit that, because our quantum computers are not so good. But it starts to give you a sense of, like, okay, there will be more problems that these approximations were bad, that we don't have to worry about them. And for sure, the obvious ones are everything that has some quantum in it. It's gonna transform things. Like, that's in if you want to think, like, very future wise, like, when quantum computers are scalable, pharma and chemistry companies, they're going to look very different. The people that work there's going to be less people with lab coats.
I mean, for this molecular geometry problems, I mean, it's just, there's such huge value there. But I mean, you could tell, I mean, from a lot of the people that are actually practitioners on current molecular geometry struggles, they're not embracing current contemporary quantum solutions right now. They're still doing the pragmatic classical thing with its many limits. It still feels like that's one area where there could be a big breakthrough. As far as we could tell, many of the big software startups in quantum algorithms have done a fairly significant pivot, many of them in that very direction of towards the molecular geometry use case. So maybe that's the first big breakthrough outcome in this space. Who knows?
And to define the molecular geometry problem, what that means is, like, if you imagine, like right now what we do is, like, those toes, that, like, you have, like, little balls and sticks and you put them together and you build something. That's how we think of molecules right now. That's a classical way to think about molecules, right? And that most of the techniques are that with some corrections. But in the end, they take these things, they jiggle them, and now look at the molecule. It moves when you shake it this way. Therefore, it has these properties. But this is wrong because atoms are not balls. They are wave functions that are very fuzzy. The connectivity between them, and these are quantum operations, essentially. And you have superposition and entanglement. This is what keeps the molecules together. So they have, like, you have to have the entanglement, otherwise there's no molecule. And so this already, like, highlights, like, okay, clearly, like, even, like, the fact that you can put, like, when you see the pictures, even the fact that they're drawing this picture, you can tell there's a lot of stuff missing. And of course, the idea will be, like, in the end, you have to do it quantum mechanically, the problem, ultimately. We have to remember, quantum mechanics was invented to solve chemistry problems. That was really it. Like, back in the day, there was a debate in science. Which one is the most fundamental, like, the chemistry or physics? And people had no idea at the time. And this was a huge debate. And then quantum physics was developed, and then it turns out you can explain the electron orbitals. So that means you could, in principle, derive the whole periodic table, like, in principle. And that was suddenly when, okay, physics is the most fundamental one. That was when physics, like, we say, like, we're the big daddy here. But before that, there was nobody new. And so it's gonna be like that too. Like, it's gonna have the same impact, not from, like, very fundamental, but in the way chemists do their work. Like, it's gonna change.
It feels like that's likely the first practical impact from these systems we're building is going to be insight into physical sciences, into chemistry, into material science, and obviously quantum physics itself, like condensed matter physics. So there's things that you can start to simulate on these machines in their current sort of imperfect calculation or information calculation state. The noise is not necessarily a barrier to scientific insight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was always from the beginning of quantum computing. because the very first proposals by Feynman and others of quantum computers was the idea, if you have a quantum problem, maybe you should embed in a quantum system and simulate it there.
Yes, right. Yeah, that very use case, right, of molecular simulation. Yeah.
And so it was like, that was really the inspiration. Then, of course, Peter Shor came and he transformed everything we think about quantum, because he came up with a factorization problem and came up with a efficient algorithm to do it better than anybody else. And this was like groundbreaking. Suddenly, like, we still do not understand, like, this gray area. Like, Peter, if you think about can you do stuff that's not, like, that's really, really good, that's not quantum? And I'm going to say Peter Shor, because there's, like, very few nobody else stands at the same level. It was like that groundbreaking.
I mean, such a thunderbolt of a breakthrough, but also, I mean, it's just set so many expectations, I think, awry for people from the outside of this industry, because they're like, wow, there's this huge breakthrough. So where are the results? I mean, we're a long, long way away from anything that could run Shor's algorithm, huh? You know, decades, maybe lifetimes, right? I mean, who knows, right?
For useful problems, right?
Right. Yeah, yes. Well, at least for that particular algorithm, right? Yeah.
Right. Because we can run Shor's algorithm. It's just, I can probably factor the number in my head.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're right.
Like the NMR experiment that IBM Research did at Almaden, where they used used NMR qubits to factor 15. That was the first implementation. Sure.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That was the very first one. And it was like, it's kind of ridiculous. Oh, 3 times 5 equals 15. That's like, who doesn't know that? My son knows it. But it was important, like a proof of principle. And that's gonna, it could be that this landscape of classical algorithms, like algorithms of classical problems that are more powerful, it could be that it's huge. And we don't know that. But I'm not surprised, because if you look at the history of classical computing, people didn't come up with the algorithm until they actually had computers to run them all.
Yeah, Shor is really unusual in that way, that he came up with an algorithm. There's absolutely no way to, like, where it came from, I have no idea. I've talked to him. He doesn't really know either.
Yeah, yeah. I think that I had many beers with Peter, and that's what I think, that's what everybody like always asking, how do you come up with this? Yeah. And Scott Aronson, when he was at MIT, I saw him give a seminar, really going into like the technical details, exactly what makes this complexity, like the complexity of this problem, what makes it so special for Shor's algorithm. And he made this was a talk he made, and in the audience was Peter Shor, and he made a point that in every slide transition, there was the head of Peter Shor like flying and crashing into stuff, and like pictures of Peter Shor like raining and everything. And the whole like audience was like laughing, including Peter.
He's like, Aronson's hilarious.
He was just laughing.
Too.
It was hilarious. Like, you see Peter Shor's head comes and destroys the old views of things. And he was like, Scott has a great sense of humor. It was just Scott's way to say, like, this was like air showering. So.
I love his talks up on YouTube. Aaron's a fun presenter. Yeah.
But he, at the end, he was like, I made sure every slide had Peter Shor's head in.
So you mentioned just before we started recording, there was some major update recently, or a major breakthrough or progress recently. What were you referring to?
Oh, yes. So in terms of hardware, like I follow very closely the existing hardware and so on. So the main hardware that we have right now, of course, like that some based on superconducting qubits, that will be like, think of IBM is investing a lot in this technology. Rigetti also has invested a lot in technology, and D-Wave has also invested in this technology. D-Wave uses superconducting qubits in a very different way than IBM's and Rigetti, because they're not gate-based, they're annealers. And the way Rigetti, D-Wave does it is very single-purpose machine. It's not like universal, but this is, it's been very valuable right now, because they can run stuff with a lot of data points more than other people, but maybe the problems they can solve are more limited. And then, of course, you have the benefits of superconducting qubits is that they're very fast. Most of it works on silicon, but not everything, because you still need superconductors to make them work and to cool them off, which is the big, big, big challenge, is to cool them off. But you can use the fab techniques that we all know and love from Intel era. Nothing has changed there. And so there's a promise that there's scalability like there. However, the quality of the qubits is not so good. And so once they've been improving consistently, they still have to pass a threshold, such that once you pass that threshold, you know that once you have qubits reliably beyond that, you can take many, many qubits to support one qubit, and it's known as error correction. So I think of it like one of those like cheerleader pyramids, where you have a lot of people holding on one on top, right? So it's a bit tight. That's kind of like error correction. And there's many techniques on how to do error correction, just like there are many cheerleader pyramids. So the other ones are ion traps. So ion traps is like you take an atom, extract an electron, it's charged. You can use like electromagnetic forces to put it in vacuum. And you can use electromagnetic forces also to compute between them. And the challenge is that you have to isolate one atom. So you have to put in a vacuum vacuum chamber. This adds a lot of complexity. And also that the way you connect them with these radio frequency signals, and it's quite slow, actually. So it's big, it's slow. And sometimes even the scalability of it is limited. Like, you don't have enough places to put more atoms.
Right. I've heard that traps can't really scale beyond about 40 atoms. Yeah.
Exactly. So then the other one that's, and there's atom computing is similar, but it doesn't use ions. And it's just a lot of lasers instead of lasers, but it has a lot of similar challenges. And the other one is photonics, quantum computing. Photonics is kind of like a really different beast, mostly because...
bosons.
Nobody has...
Because they're bosons.
Because they're bosons. And they're just very simple. If like you need to make light interact with light, and if you take two flashlights and point them at each other, they just like Lego through, right? Light doesn't want to interact with them. So that's a big challenge. That's like, it's very hard to make the gates. But there's many people doing them. Of course, the benefit of that is like, if they get them to work right, you don't have to worry about these issues of cooling them or vacuum chambers. But nobody has shown like a scalable way. And so these are like roughly the three categories. There are more nuanced than that. Something that was missing in the industrial players was something based on silicon. So something that is really like solid state devices, like more similar. And so of course, I studied engineering, so I had to learn a lot of p-n junctions and so on for your diodes, which is you extract some electrons from one place, you dope them in the other, and you use. And so the idea was like, can you do that? Can you just like you dope a big silicon wafer one way, and then you dope it the other way, and you glue them together to make diodes and transistors and so on? Can you like take one atom and just like extract one electron, and that can you use that to manipulate the atom? And the answer is yes, of course you can do that, but doing operations is quite challenging still. And a few weeks ago in Nature, there were three different independent teams in Nature. Nature, of course, is the biggest science journal. There were three independent teams, and that show that they had this kind of they called like NV centers. This is for vacancies, because they extract an electron to create a hole. It's the vacancy. So they showed that using this kind of qubits, that they were able to surpass this threshold to get to error correction like this. And this is really, really big. Because maybe there's a way that nobody has done computers right now in terms of the industry to make scalable computers.
Like a whole new architecture, right? A whole new branch of the tree, yeah.
That whole new architecture, completely new architecture. So the question is this the transistor moment? And I would say, like, I think we don't know yet. There's still a lot of questions about interconnecting them and the actual practicalities of scaling.
Well, isn't there a speed issue as well, Cesar? When I saw it, in the diamond NV centers, the coherence times were really long, but to interact with them was very, very slow, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. Yeah. That's it. So they were able to show, they were able to do two NV centers in one place. So those were fast. But beyond that, the question is out there. Absolutely. This is the question. I will say there's still, once, if that is resolved, then we will look back and think this was a transistor moment. But until then, we should not claim that yet.
Right. It could be it's flash RAM, maybe quantum RAM, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
That's really interesting news. I hadn't seen that fly by on the news feed. So that's a good one to know about. I will look up those Nature papers. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's for me, it's very exciting because somebody's doing something new, and it's like it has some promise. We'll see where it gets. Of course, science takes a while. It's not gonna be like in 6 months. There's gonna be companies doing this. It's gonna.
Yeah.
We still need more papers before people have confidence. But like this is exciting that I we're looking at news articles and thinking like, is this the transistor moment? Because it's such a huge moment. Are we seeing it in front of our eyes? For me, I love that part about the industry.
That's the coolest thing about this reading group we did with the study and this podcast. Is so you feel like you're given a ringside seat, a view of history.
Yeah, or not. It could be not history. We don't know.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly. It's just revealing itself. Who knows?
Exactly. All right. So we've got just a couple minutes left, Cesar. Anything you want to touch on before we wrap up?
No, I think this was a really fun conversation with you guys. Yeah.
Well, I hope you had fun, man. Yeah. We had a blast. Yeah. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Very much so.
That was, I thought, a fun interview with Cesar. He's a fun guy to hang out with. And he's been really, really, I think, a helpful mentor and guide. And for me, and I think you, Sebastian, yeah. Also in terms of grappling with understanding quantum mechanics. I hope it's clear that what we're trying so hard to do with this podcast is deliver to people who are non-physicists, right, some deeper level of understanding from the perspective of technology and those trends. I really enjoyed his reasoned and balanced view of both the potential applications on one hand and the frank admission of the serious current limits. It's hard, I think, to have both of those views in your mind at the same time. It's a little bit fatiguing for some people, but I think it's the appropriate way to see this space.
Yeah, in particular, I liked the discussion of variational approaches because those are generating the most sort of interest in this NISQ era with these intermediate scale machines that are quite noisy. There's still some hope that marrying classical compute resources with quantum machines at this nascent stage will yield some kind of advantage. And also the discussion about quantum supremacy and quantum advantage was really, really great.
That was interesting. And that might have, for some of the listeners, flown on by rather quick. It was just a short set of remarks there. But it turns out that there's numerous examples, recently even, right, of essentially prominent advances that got a lot of hype in quantum computing that were later retracted. It's called a dequantization event, where the perceived advantage of the quantum computer or the algorithm is found to be false, and we have to reconsider.
Yeah, as Cesar said, it turns out it doesn't need to be entangled. I love the framing of quantum information science is information science just with all of the information, right? And it turns out that yes. So far, most problems that we've looked at don't actually need all of the information. You can find a subset and a narrower approach that yields a sufficient answer. So it's a really fascinating exploration.
Yeah, very interesting and treacherous mathematics. Yes. So watch out. Yeah, I guess that it was really interesting. We had that little back and forth about the quantum supremacy result that was announced by Google all the way back in, I think, 2019. So we touched on it then, but since that recording, I mean, just the last couple of days while we've been in production on this podcast, it was well announced, prominently announced that a team in China had found a way to exactly replicate the precise same quantum supremacy results that Google did, but on a classical computer with classical algorithms and just a normal everyday supercomputer. So it's got to be actually probably the most pronounced dequantization event. I'm not sure if most people have been watching the press on this one. The news of dequantization is less greeted with optimism and
the retraction is never as big as the headline, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
It's still, as Cesar pointed out, though, it's still, I think we and maybe the press is somewhat to blame for this. We over-index on the announcement, on the significance of the actual advantage, and don't recognize in the larger context that this kind of exploration is necessary. We won't find real advantage unless we find all the ways in which it might manifest itself that don't turn out to be true, right? That's the scientific that's right. method. Yeah. You got to disprove everything, really.
Yeah, it's an adventure that does involve stubbing your toe. Yeah. It was also, I thought, really cool to close in our remarks around, you know, Cesar gesturing towards, you know, new innovations that were happening, you know, while we were near the time that we were talking, around brand new quantum computing architectures, which appear to represent, you know, possibly new breakthroughs that could provide massively more scalable manufacturing technique at, you know, not maybe full zero Kelvin fridge temperatures. So I wonder, Sebastian, I think you have a firmer command of those innovations.
So what he was referring to is nitrogen vacancies in diamond. It's a technique for popping electron out, actually, and using that hole as the qubit, essentially. The advantage is very long coherence times. The T1 times are quite long. They can be, you know, seconds, or even in some instances longer, like minutes. Which is kind of amazing to think about when you think of the, you know, how hard it's been for superconducting qubits to get to 1 millisecond T1 times. The challenge has been manufacturing the performance. So it takes a long time to interact with these types of qubits. There's been some suggestion they might be better suited for RAM or memory storage. But I think there are also people working on techniques for increasing the gate readout speed. But the paper that Cesar was referring to was, I think he said, three different independent groups all came up with a benchmark that showed that they could maintain coherence longer than required for error correction. So they could implement error correction effectively in these diamond vacancies. Which is really exciting. That means essentially if they can tackle the fab challenges and the performance challenges, we have a qubit that is amenable to error correction out of the gate, which is a big, big jump.
And so we don't know for sure, but we could be living through these days, right? That transistor moment, so to speak, for quantum.
That, I think that framing is really... That and the Wright Brothers one, which was delightful as well. That's the reason why I am compelled by this field, right? This is why I keep coming back and trying to figure out exactly what's going on, even despite all the complications and the difficulty in that entails, is because we have the potential of living through another moment that is that transformative, as transformative the moment when Bell Labs invented the solid state transistor and we were off to the race, and Moore's law really started to kick in.
That's right. Yeah, a ringside seat on these developments. I mean, that's what really, really attracts us to this whole area. I think it would be useful for our audience, Sebastian, to go back and just review this sort of idea of coherence and T1 time. That's a trade term that perhaps some of our listeners need more context on. Would you be willing to take a go at better explaining?
Sure. As a total non-expert, T1 is a time, is the time that a qubit maintains a coherent state. So the superposition it's put into, the entanglement that it's involved in other qubit with other qubits, that is effectively in existence for a very, very short period of time, because, you know, the universe does not like to have little tiny bits of it isolated. It likes to be, as Cesar said, like to be a molecule or to be an atom, it has to be fully entangled. All the pieces of it have to be fully entangled. And so what we're doing is splitting off tiny quantum subatomic particles and isolating them in time and space so that we can interact with them in a controlled way and perform calculations. So that time window is vanishingly small. As I said, superconducting qubits only recently reached the 1 millisecond T1 time.
1 millisecond. years. It's just amazing,
right? It is. So, I mean, that is among the many, 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 many fundamental challenges that exist for making quantum computers work.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much potential, but also these quantum states with so much power, I mean, they can be so easily, they're so fragile, they can be so easily disrupted by the slightest intrusion, right, of a bit of Brownian motion from heat nearby, or who knows, a cosmic ray. There's all these ways that the whole calculation can be wiped out by ambient conditions.
That's absolutely right.
So there it is. I mean, increasing coherence time shows that there's actually novel new architectures that could perhaps be way more resilient for those fundamental challenges that nearly the entire space faces.
That's right.
All right. Well, there it is. I hope we're living the transistor moment, but we're skeptical. We'll see.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at Podfly. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.